I know.
To try to warm up.
I'm always cold, but when I saw other people, there's one lady that's like going to the bathroom right behind you. That's her cold face, her outside cold face she's just had on the whole time.
If everyone would take a seat, we'd really like to start. We have an hour left. Okay, please everyone take a seat. We're going to continue our roundtable and move on to topic three, and Lisa will talk about, or tee us up to talk about the scope of the proposal.
Great, thank you. If everyone can turn to page six, this is going to be for questions 9 through 11. And we're going to be covering the definition of a lease and separating components in a contract. Just as a refresher, the definition of a lease in this ED is a contract that conveys the right to use an asset, the underlying asset, for a period of time in exchange for consideration. This is going to be dependent upon whether there's an identified asset and whether the lessee has control. As far as separating lease and non-lease components, a lessee is going to be required to separate if they are able to obtain a standalone observable price. And again, with that, I'll open it up to everybody here participating. We'd like to hear whether you agree, whether you disagree, if you disagree, why, and any potential recommendations.
Okay. We'd like to start off the discussion on the scope of the proposal. Thank you, Marianne.
So I guess I can give some comments specific to our industry. So for all of you that read our letter are probably familiar with what we're going to talk about in terms of scope and a potential carve-out. So within our industry, we have a term called direct costs, and that means those are those costs that we incur specifically in the performance of our obligations to our customers. And many times we lease assets, equipment, in the performance of our contracts, and we would not enter into those contracts except for those contracts, those lease contracts, except for the contracts we've entered into our clients. And so the proposal would make us apply the guidance to such assets, and we believe that would be distortive. First of all, we'd have to put liabilities up on the balance sheet with no offsetting benefit from our customers. So we would have the liability, but yet there would be no benefit showing that our customers are either obligated to pay for those assets or that they're included in our cost estimates with the customer has approved. So we truly don't get the economic benefit of those leases. The benefits of those leases are simultaneously transferred and consumed by our customers. So we're asking from the perspective of the construction industry that there would be a carve-out for those type of leases that are entered in solely for the performance under a contract with the customer and are entered into for no other reason. And we probably would say that, you know, they would be treated like short-term leases. They would not be up on the balance sheet, and we would have a straight-lined rent expense. The other issue we would have, you know, most of those most likely would fall into a type A situation. So we would have the front-end loading. And in a cost-to-cost under RevRec, you would actually recognize more revenue up front than you would today because the cost would flow directly to that job when in calculating the revenue. So we also think it would cause a distortion, not necessarily at the end of the day. It would cause a distortion in the timing, though, for revenue recognition. We think these lease assets are distinct from other assets that are used in the core part of the business and which are general-purpose assets that that we would get the benefit from. So we do think that there is a distinction for these types of leases.
Anyone have any follow-up questions for Mary Ann?
I was just wondering, you said you would like it to be treated similar to short-term leases. And just to clarify, they do not need to be recognized on the balance sheet, and they would have a straight-line P&L, but they would still be disclosed?
You would still have disclosure.
Okay.
And the reason we would show this liability for these expenses. I mean, we would make them akin to any type of a subcontractor, for example. We entered a subcontract agreement in the performance. We would have to show this liability with no offsetting benefit. So it would be a little bit distortive, we believe, to the users of our financial statements to see, okay, we've incurred a liability, but the liability will be a direct cost of the job, but yet we don't show the offsetting benefit. And we would have to give significant disclosure to explain that to the users of financial statements that, yes, we've incurred this liability, but we have this off balance sheet right to be reimbursed for that liability.
George Loros.
So these are lease contracts that are tied to a specific program. Is those the leases you're talking about?
Yeah, so we would have a construction contract and we're building a bridge or whatever it may be, and we need to lease a crane. We've identified that crane, and we lease the crane specific for that project. And usually, because of the logistics of our projects, it's not like you can use that crane in multiple projects. They're usually project-specific. And the length of it is usually tied to the length of the contract, so we try to do that matching.
And then if the contract was to go to another company, would the lease transfer with that project, or would it end?
Well, the lease would be with us, and we leased on behalf of that project. So you're saying if a project ended early?
Right, or? So is it it's the company that has the obligation, not the...
Yes, we have the obligation, okay. But we basically are de facto intermediaries. I mean, it's basically a pass-through cost. So just like with a subcontractor...
Yeah, that's what I was trying to understand, if it was a pass-through.
It's basically a pass-through cost. Wherein our customers are obligated to pay. I mean, it's either explicitly stated, or it could be in our cost estimates, wherein the customer has approved those cost estimates.
Thank you.
Darrell Buck.
Do you have any equipment that you own, but you own it for the purpose of using it on these jobs and passing that cost straight through?
All the industries will be different, and I think that... or at least the companies within the industry are different. For us, I think most of ours are leased. We do have some owned equipment, and you know, we do pass that through.
I'm sorry, I'm having a difficult time understanding. To Daryl's point, I mean, this is a choice that people in your industry are making. They could own that equipment and transfer it from job to job, or they could decide to lease it for 2 to 3 years or for as long as the project. So what would be the basis for the scope out? I don't understand it. Regardless of where we go on the project, I mean, currently you're accounting for those as operating leases, right?
Yes.
Okay, so
Do you owe the money to who you're leasing it from if your customer doesn't pay you?
Yes, but we would have a claim against the customer.
Pardon me?
We would have a claim against the customer for that. I mean, we akin it to subcontractors, right? So there's, you know, we have personnel. And those personnel, we incur that cost no matter if they're on a job or not. But for those specific projects, we might hire subcontractors because they have a specialty or we have an increased need. We would look at some of that equipment similar to that. It may be specific just to that project, and we may have no use for it after that project.
Jim Croker.
Is your concern the balance sheet treatment or the P&L, because it's basically a pass-through, you know, sort of a pass-through cost? So, you know, your point on you get the accelerated recognition, it basically just accelerates revenue and cost to cost, or is it also the balance?
It's both. Obviously, if we're, you know, having a piece of equipment that basically is a pass-through, we have to put up the liability. But in the agreement, the customer has agreed that, you know, we will pay you for the cost of this asset. We don't show that offsetting benefit on the balance sheet. So we're only showing one side of the equation. And then obviously there's the P&L impact.
Marianne, in your example with the crane, just to clarify, did you say that the crane is leased only for the project, or it could be leased for a period of time and it will be used for that project, but then you might have a period afterwards where it's still available for your use?
So typically we would lease it for a specific project and try to tie it to the project timing. Obviously, the project ended early, or if something happened, we would have to make a decision, but more likely than not, we would return it to the lessor.
Okay, and there's only one lease agreement, right? There's no sublease. Although I understand you pass the cost.
Yeah, there is no sublease. It's just it's in part of your cost roll-up. So it's either in your cost estimate, or it could be a specific line item within your agreement that says they will pay for that.
I find it just very intriguing that you're making the recommendation you are, because in one of our advisory groups, we have a particular member of that advisory group who is from your industry, and he has unequivocally on numerous occasions encouraged us to plow forward with this particular project, because at the end of the day, he fully admits that he structures his leases and can get whatever he wants. So I'm almost quoting. Am I not fairly accurate in my quotations of him?
Yes.
So I find it intriguing.
Okay. Other comments or issues with scope of the proposal? Go ahead, Rick.
Well, I have a couple of comments about scope. It's starting with the first one, just a very basic one, the difference between a lease and a sale. The exposure draft and the basis for conclusions makes the point that a lease, it transfers control of the underlying asset to the lessee, and I'm assuming control is being used there in the way it's defined in the revenue recognition project. It says it's not a lease, it's a sale. I understand that, and I agree with that. I would recommend to the board that they make that statement up in the fore part of the document, where someone can find it in the codification, that, you know, that it is possible that something that says lease at the top of the page is in fact a sale. The second thing along that same line is there's an example that is in the exposure draft that talks about what I would refer to as kind of a subtype of a synthetic lease. where the lessee agrees that at the end of the lease term, the lessee will sell the asset on behalf of the lessor. And there's also an arrangement where there's a residual value guarantee and a fixed price purchase option. So all the economics at the end go to the lessee as well. I would have thought, and that's a pretty small type of limit, you know, in the greater scheme of leases, but they're out there. I was surprised to have an example of that in the ED, where I thought that was kind of the prime example that would be a sale. Because in that particular situation, the asset is not expected to ever revert back to the lessor. The lessee has agreed to sell it at the end of the lease term. So my point here is just saying I think it would be useful somewhere in the document to make this point about if control transfers as defined in the revenue recognition project, it doesn't matter, it says lease at the top of the page. It's you go to the revenue recognition project. And then secondly, to think about that example you have in here to make sure that it's an example of something that really is a lease.
I think part of the thought process, and it may not be complete, so I'd like you to fill in the gaps, is that in most of those instances, you get type A lease account. And is type A lease accounting any different than sale accounting? So is it worthwhile splitting up? Most of the type A leases are the types that you might say are purchases. So I think that was the preliminary thought, whether it was worth dividing it up if the eventual accounting was basically the same. We may be missing something.
No, I think the accounting should be basically the same, but it still struck me that it was strange to say that in the basis for conclusions, but not to say that in what would end up in the codification.
Kimber?
The point about the scope and whether a transaction that is in fact a sale should be out of the scope of the document, I think is a fair point. I think it's also, though, fair to expect that a properly constructed accounting model for something that is a lease that is in substance the same as a sale ought to give you the same result as if you had accounted for it as a sale. And I think on the lessor side, the transaction that Rick was describing probably does that. I'm not sure that it does on the lessee side because of the way that the lessee measures residual guarantees. And I don't know that it's clear in that example that that payment should be considered a residual guarantee payment by the lessee or a lease payment by the lessee. And you get a different result depending upon which approach you take. But I think it's useful for the boards to try to test whatever your model is against what you would get if the transaction was in substance the same as a sale. On the control guidance itself, I think we had some concerns about the clarity of that guidance. In certain respects, there are elements of the guidance that read a lot like the guidance around consolidation, for example, and yet it seems like it's meant to be working a little bit differently than that. There's some of it that seems to read similar to revenue recognition, and yet this seems to be more directed at the control of the use of the asset versus the control of the asset, which could be two different things. So we had some concern that the guidance wasn't quite as clear as it could be. We had some concerns around arrangements in which the purchaser is taking all of the output of a particular asset, and there's an example that suggests that the owner controls the asset in that circumstance, which we kind of struggled with because, frankly, if you're taking all of the output of an asset, we sort of struggled with why that wouldn't be the sort of most important element of the economic utility of the asset. So there's elements of this that we thought needed to be clarified if you move forward with it. Alternatively, we would have been comfortable with keeping the guidance that we have now about what is a lease from EITF 018 and IFRIC 4 with some clarifications around things like pricing and unit of account, those sorts of issues.
Kimber, would it be fair to say that some of the observations you're sharing now are consistent with not being precise and consistent with what we mean the asset is?
I think that is part of the issue, yes.
Any other comments on scope of the proposal? Okay, if not, we'll move on to the next area, which is other aspects of the proposal, and I'll briefly tee that up. The exposure draft contains various other proposals, including proposals regarding transition and disclosure. Transition is the boards provide for a modified retrospective approach with certain simplifications and reliefs. They also allow, however, the use of full retrospective approach. In the area of disclosures, there's various quantitative, qualitative, and general disclosures that were proposed, both for lessees and lessors. Finally, in the exposure draft, there are also some proposed specified reliefs for non-public entities, that is, private companies and not-for-profit organizations, one around the area of an accounting policy election to use a risk-free rate of comparable duration in lieu of a risk-adjusted or a lessee's incremental borrowing rate, because of concerns that we heard from some of our advisory groups and others that particularly smaller, but some other private companies and not-for-profit organizations that may not be doing much borrowing may not know what their incremental borrowing rate is. And then there was also a proposed exemption from the requirement to provide a reconciliation of the opening and closing balance of the lease liability for non-public entities. I think we also touched upon earlier that there is some change in guidance that's being proposed with regard to related party leases. Not try to look through to the what could be deemed to be the underlying substance, but instead focus on the legally enforceable form and provisions of the lease. So with that as backdrop, do you have any specific concerns about those other proposals in the exposure draft, in particular the proposals about transition, disclosure, and non-public entity reliefs? Is there anything we can do to make the standard better if you object to any of those? Who wants to start us off? Go ahead, George.
Yes, particularly on the disclosure. The one thing that we've noted is the roll forwards of the finance receivable and the residual asset. And the first thing that came to mind was when the FASB first proposed the finance receivable and credit quality disclosures, they had roll forward information in there. And then when the standard came out, that roll forward activity was removed. We view leasing as a financing activity. And so from our perspective, why would you put roll forwards in a disclosure when you didn't do it for the, you propose it and then remove them from the loan side? Because we think that they're kind of similar in terms of what we're trying to convey. Having said that, breaking out the two components is the primary reason for the type A model. If you didn't have to break them apart for the disclosure, you wouldn't need the type A model to kind of do that. The other piece that we struggle with, partly related to disclosure, but primarily related to impairment is, we have a single asset, yet if we split this apart and we start looking at impairment, our risk people look at it as basically what's the carrying value and what's the value of the vehicle in the future to figure out if we have any kind of residual impairment on that residual asset. They don't make a difference between what is allocated between the finance receivable and the residual. So that would be a very complex exercise that we would have to do behind the scenes, which wouldn't be reflective of the people that are actually managing the risk. So in terms of the level of disclosure, breaking it apart and the amount of work, we're concerned that going through that exercise would basically potentially misrepresent what the risk folks are seeing and what the nature of the of what we're trying to do is.
George, can I follow up on that? Did I understand you to say that your people, in assessing the carrying amounts of these assets, would not look at the financing receivable different than they would the residual amount? I mean, it seems like on the financing receivable, they'd be assessing collectability versus
collectability. But in the event of something happening, one of the biggest factors to determine whether you're how much you're going to lose on a particular contract is what's the value of the vehicle. So think about a loan, for example. If a customer doesn't pay on the loan, I have to go and repossess the vehicle. My loss is going to be offset by the value of the vehicle. Well, a lease works the same way, except now what you're proposing is I have a finance receivable on one side and a residual, where from a business perspective, I'm indifferent because all I care about is what's my carrying value and what is my value of that vehicle to determine the net component.
But, and this may not be appropriate in your industry, but maybe in some others. It seems to me that even if you would assess that the financing receivable was fully collectible, you still may have an impairment issue with the residual because you may be carrying it at a value that now you've determined is too high.
Right, but that impairment is not today, it's in the future. So currently what I'm doing is if I think I have a residual, an expected residual value that's going to be higher than what I think I'm ultimately going to get, I take depreciation to kind of adjust that going forward. Because at the end of the day, when the vehicle comes back, I don't want a gain, I don't want a loss. I'm trying to get it to the point where I'm basically spot on. The risk people tell me it's almost impossible, but they're trying to get it to where they're minimizing the noise around the gain loss on the back end. And so from their perspective, looking at it from a financing and a residual, that's not the way they look at it. And so what we would be doing is we'd be an allocation. We'd be saying, okay, there's no collectibility on the receivable and we have the risk on the residual, which, you know, may or may not be the case depending on if you get the car back. If you don't get the car back, everything's gone.
I wonder if Elias would have a comment on that with regard to residual values of airplanes.
From a residual perspective, you know, even there's potential to have impairments even before you get to the end of the lease if you're looking at it separately. And especially under, it increases the likelihood of a potential impairment with the proposed ED because, you know, we've now kind of adjusted it to evaluation that's based on internal forecasts. If in my view is like, all right, on an A320, once it gets to 18 years, I think I'm going to be making 10% less. And depending if we're comparing undiscounted cash to undiscounted cash, or now I'm looking at discounted cash to what I'm carrying the residual, it increases the likelihood of an impairment.
Sounds to me like you're describing a setting where you've got a receivable contract that you may not be collecting all of it, but net you're not going to be worse off because the residual went up in value. And then so sum total, you don't think you've got an impairment setting.
Well, the idea is that we set the pricing for leases is based on a contractual value. We have an expected residual value that's going to be what the vehicle's be worth in the future. We are constantly adjusting to that. Under this, now we have your residual asset, which how would you adjust that residual in the future? Would you take additional depreciation on that? Well, based on the way the standard looks, you would almost look at it as a mini eye impairment to try to adjust that residual in the future. But overall, what we're trying to do is we're trying to figure out is if we're collecting all the payments, then everything would be on the residual. But through the life of that lease, if something was to happen where we would have to go and get that vehicle, or if it was a skip and the vehicle was gone, we'd be looking at everything. And that's the way the risk people look at it. They look at it in total. So, yeah, we can break apart the components and do an allocation and come up with it. But from an internal standpoint, is it more important to talk about the allocation or really what we're doing from a business perspective?
I think you are. I did describe the situation that you're talking about. You're not getting all your money, but you have to go get the vehicle. You make yourself whole, right?
Right.
Because the vehicle is going to be, if it's appreciated in value or you underestimated the expected residual at that time period, you can make yourself whole. So that's an issue. But it seems to me the potential benefit. I understand you got a unit of account problem here then, in terms of where the impairment is if you look at them separately. But it seems to me that in understanding your business, understanding not just whether you can collect your cash flows, but how much residual risk you have, is really important to understanding the total return. And splitting the two assets has the ability to evaluate more so where when you are in a loss position in your residual. So your expected residual when you priced the contract was X, but it's gone down now. So even if you collect all your cash flows, you're probably not going to have as much of a positive return, or even a positive return. What is the problem? Is that not beneficial to understand the economics of both the airline and the car leases?
And if you were talking about a single lease, it probably would be. But with the volume of our leases, you're going to get wrapped into a situation where you've got this kind of revolving asset based on our portfolio. You know, because we're talking about a very homogenous pool of leases, low dollars, high volume, when you start rolling this through the disclosure, I don't know what that's going to have, because we have a portion of it that's going to go full term. We have some that we're going to have a credit issue on that they might not pay. We have some that the vehicles might disappear, which we might not get any recoverability. But we're managing that business to understand, okay, what percentage of this portfolio do we think we're going to have a loss on? But we're unable to specifically identify which vehicle it is.
And that goes back to your prior point that you really control the secondary market in selling those cars, and you have a very good prediction about what the average price would be.
Right.
But that's far different than Elias's.
Yeah, in our case on the aircraft, you know, we have a long-lived asset. We evaluate them regularly for recoverability, and we consider the current lease and what we could do with the plane after the current lease. And, you know, I have a much smaller volume than what George has. You know, we have operating leases about 910 aircraft, so we can do a one-by-one, and to the extent it's impaired, we do disclose that and disclose not just the dollar amount of the impairment, but how many aircraft, and sometimes, depending how material it is, what types of aircrafts are getting impaired and why.
Thank you. Daryl.
Yeah, I was just going to ask the staff maybe if they could refresh my memory. I know that we had gotten some feedback from users who liked the fact that our proposal might shed more light on the residual. Do you think that that was primarily from users of financials of companies that would be more like in Elias's group, that would have sort of a smaller group of leased assets versus these really high volume situations, or did they make any distinction?
I don't think there was any distinction. I just think in general users want to know what the value of those leased assets will be and just have some more visibility into the values.
Yeah, the feedback we've gotten from the users of our financials, whether it's rating agencies, investors, or equity analysts, is, and you know, you get one of them was Standards & Poor's, and they've responded. The other one is an equity analyst in our space. They like what they get today. It's easy to understand. It gives them what they need for their analytics. The proposed ED takes away from them, and the information becomes less usable. Now, we've heard that some would like more information on what residuals we're using. Well, we'd like to understand what kind of information, because we think that could be dealt with through disclosure and not necessarily changing the recognition and measurement model. The feedback we got on the recognition and measurement model, everyone is satisfied with what we have today.
Anyone else on the area of disclosures or transition or non-public entity reliefs?
Just with respect to non-public entities, while we would agree that using the risk-free rate is fine, I think the default should be if the incremental borrowing rate is known for those mm-hmm. that do borrow, then that should be what they use.
And that is what the proposal says, that's... It is an accounting policy option. Okay, great. Elias, you have more? Then
so the comment I have is on transition is, you know, as the board thinks through the ultimate model, be mindful, at least for us, you know, the implementation of a different recognition and measurement model could mean a significant investment in our systems and how we do things, people building up additional capabilities that we don't do today. And that takes time and it takes money. The other aspect of it is we think from the user's perspective, what's the most meaningful when it comes to transition? Obviously, from their perspective is a full retrospective model, which now adds tremendous more complexity and cost. And when we think of the full retrospective, for us who are public companies, we have five-year historical tables we have to present in the MD&A. So it's not just what's showing up in the financial statements. We have to worry about the last 5 years to do that. And that adds tremendous complexity. We don't, depending what the model is, we may or may not have the right data for it.
Elias, would the modified retrospective approach that was proposed make much of a difference?
So it makes it easier for us to implement. I'm not sure how useful it's going to be for the users of the financials. So I'm going to sit down with an analyst or someone else and say, all right, this is what's happening today. And they're going to say, well, how can I understand that relative to what it was last year? And that's going to be, that's, I think, is going to be an issue.
But I think that's exactly what the board's trying to do in making the trade-off. We understand that on an information basis, full retrospective makes lots more sense. But we also are very cognizant of the cost of doing this. And either you're going to have the benefits at huge costs or reduce the benefits at limited costs, and we're trying to balance that.
Understood.
Go ahead, Larry.
So before I say this, I just want to remind everybody of what I said before, that each of us is speaking for ourselves, so don't take anything into what I'm about to ask. I'm interested, and Elias, your comment on modified retrospective might give some indication as to how useful you think this approach might be going forward. But there's even a more a less costly implementation methodology that generally the board has just dismissed, and dismissed real quickly from the standpoint that you'd have financial statements that might not be very comparable for a long period of time. But that being the case, if everybody were to acknowledge that one of the major objectives of the project is to put a liability on the balance sheet, then some people might be willing to entertain something that I'll put forward. And I'm curious as to operationally how difficult this might be, and is it worth even considering? And that is, what if the boards decided, whatever the final standard would be, that it could be implemented on a prospective basis for new leases and or, you know, new lease modifications, with the stipulation that for existing leases that you continue to include a separate summary of what your lease obligations are over the remaining, you know, 1 to 5 year periods and beyond, whatever. Yeah. And then a separate chart for what your lease obligations are under the new methodology so that the user theoretically can add them together and do whatever they magic they usually do in terms of comparing the liabilities. Would that actually, while on surface it looks like that would reduce the cost of implementation dramatically because you don't have to go back and rerun all of your thousands of leases that some people say they have. But yet, on a go-forward basis, you'd have to maintain multiple systems in order to account for the old leases as well as the new leases. So is that something worth considering, or can we just put that to bed?
All right. Now, Marianne is next to speak, but in the meantime, any reactions to Larry's suggestion or proposal? Okay, George.
Yeah, the point I was going to make earlier was, in terms of the transition methods, because of the volume of our leases, we would have to do basically a full retrospective, but the modified would kind of help us when we go back further. On your proposal about doing it prospectively, we actually looked at that as one of the options under the first exposure draft. The issue that we have is, depending on the model that's being proposed, can we have a system that can do both sets of an accounting? If we were simply moving from a operating lease to a capital lease DFL structure, Our servicing system can do that, so that would probably be okay. I'm not going to say it would be, you know, not costly, but we would incur some costs, but it would be something we would explore. If we're talking about a new model, then we would have to come up with a system to do that. And so depending on how we would go about doing that to transition that, we would need to understand. But the idea is if you had a new system and an old system, you'd have to run them in parallel, which would be another cost that we would have to look at. So, you know, without kind of, you know, going into the details, it's an interesting proposal, but we would want more time to kind of think about what the cost would be of something like that.
It seems like that might be more palatable to a user of a company's financials who has sort of a lot of turnover, short-term lease transactions, because this tail would be so short, you could get to comparability in a relatively short period of time. You talk about it in terms of, you know, real estate, where you've got maybe some longer terms, et cetera, you could really have non-comparability for a long time, and it seems like you also, to keep up with those two, you know, could be burdensome. I'm just thinking out loud, but.
Okay. Any other lessees or lessors with a reaction to Larry's suggestion before?
So that might be something we would consider depending on the model, especially based on the initial feedback we've got from our analysts, that if we're under type A, we're going to have to give them anyway non-GAAP measures to be able to evaluate us. So that might be an easier way from doing the implementation, and we'll figure out how we give them the information they need outside the income statement.
Is the non-GAAP measure issue a problem with the statement of cash flows primarily? That under a type A lease, you've got the cash flows divided into multiple line items all over the place. Is that the primary issue, or is it the statement of comprehensive income?
The issue is the income statement. It's not the statement of cash flows. And right now, they use our income statement to evaluate the business. Almost all of us use the indirect method anyway on the statement of cash flow, so they're not going to get it from there. What our analysts want to see is rent. How much are we collecting in rent? And what's happening on releases, because it plays out in that rent, and what's happening to collections. They look at depreciation expense. That's the cost of the asset we have. Our industry, because we generally generate net operating losses, is evaluated on a pre-tax operating basis. So they get a lot of their inputs into their models and evaluating us from the income statement today. By converting to a type A model, that information is not meaningful to them. And the discussions we've had with them is what measures will we have to give them? And it's coming back, well, I need to get from you what you used to give me. I don't need this stuff.
Mary Ann, back to you if you want to comment on that.
Yes, one other comment I just want to make is I think, you know, that it's consistent theme in most of the letters is that there will be a sizable cost incurred by companies as a result of the transition, as well as the continuing, meeting the continuing requirements of the standard. And so I just want to point out we do have another standard that is just around the corner that we're going to have to implement, and that's the revenue standard. And so I'm hoping that the boards can maybe consider, in terms of disclosures and transition, just how much people can absorb in terms of change and cost, and recognize that, you know, if these overlap, it can create quite an amount of burden, as well as just the overall communication to our stakeholders. That's a lot of change, even for the users to absorb. It's a lot of education within our own internal resources. We're moving from, you know, bright lines on revenue to more principles-based. And, you know, at the end of the day, the goal is to have quality financial statements, and sometimes too much change, even though it's meant to be the better, may not lead ourselves to, at the end of the day, getting those quality statements. So I just hope the board recognizes that, you know, we all want the same thing, provide useful information to our stakeholders, but we are concerned about the burden of perhaps having two major standards that have to be implemented at the same time.
Okay. Was there anything else on specifically on transition or are those other or disclosures before we move on to final statements? Okay, go ahead.
Just make a quick comment. I don't know that extending the length of the transition period helps to resolve the issue with financial and loan covenants that borrowers will be facing. once this rule would be implemented and the assets and liabilities would be put on their financial statements. There are certainly a lot of financial instruments that are long-term, and so it would seem that just a relatively long by near-term standards, 2-3 year transition might not be sufficient to allow folks to avoid that. And it's not just an uncomfortable situation; it really is forcing borrowers to go to the table without any sort of leverage whatsoever, and really be beholden to the whim of their lender.
Okay, Jim Croker.
So we had some discussions with private companies about this standard, I guess it was last week, and they did say that certainly the covenant issue is a real one, that this for many could impact covenants, but did think, at least given some extended transition period, this was private companies, that they would generally, and it's generalization, but generally be able to deal with lenders, depending on the nature of the change to modify. That, again, that was a generalization. It was private companies, but at least didn't seem to have the sense that they were going to be held over the barrel. That's just the response that we got there.
Tom?
But not that it wasn't a real issue.
Yeah, we're really cognizant of that issue, and it isn't. This won't be the first time, if we proceed with recognizing a liability on the books, that there's debt covenant issues. It's historically over the board with pensions, OPEB benefits, etc. Lease liabilities the first time for purchase things, that there has been the need to recontract. And I think it's our responsibility to understand the process that was undertaken previously, the time period that it took, the outcomes of it in evaluating how best to proceed with transition periods and to think about the issues that arise.
Okay. So, all right, go ahead, Darrell.
Yeah, just one other comment on that topic. For a lot of companies, their debt covenants are measured with an element of lease capitalization included in it currently. And as you know, many capitalize those operating leases using a multiple 7 or 8 times or whatever. We've actually gotten some evidence that in some cases the leverage ratio actually will improve for companies by implementing the standard too. So it's not all, a one-way negative thing with regard to the leverage ratio, and I just wanted to point that out for balance.
Okay. I wanted to conclude this before turning it back to Danielle on next steps to go around the table and with the idea of brevity, because I do want to make sure everyone has a chance to talk here, anything that you haven't previously stressed in this roundtable that you'd like to stress now, any kind of recap, go ahead, Jeremy, start with you.
probably on a couple of areas. One is that, just to reinforce what we said earlier and what was said earlier by others, I think there needs to be additional guidance for the impairment on the residual asset as to how to calculate it, what information generally should be considered as part of that. The continuing on the impairment theme, what does it mean for the right of use asset to be impaired? Can it be impaired? If we're measuring, if the asset is meant to convey the right to use that asset during a period of time, if they were to stop using that asset, they still have the right to use it, and therefore does it constitute an impairment.
So that's okay. Thank you, Jeremy. Heidi?
Yes, first I just wanted to say thank you to the board for facilitating this roundtable today. I hope that it has been useful for you. In terms of our industry and our company specifically, we strongly support the dual accounting model. We do believe that there are different types of leases, and we do believe in the consumption model, and specifically for real estate, the Type B lease being appropriate. We would ask the boards to consider extending the Type B definition to include land-only leases as well, again, under the consumption model. Separately, in terms of scope, one of the things that I didn't mention before that I just wanted to bring up, and we did address this in our comment letter, and I know that NAREIT addressed it in their comment letter, as well as some of our other peers, relates to the reimbursement of landlord costs under leases. So when we have a full-service lease, a full-service gross lease, a component of that rental income is it includes the reimbursement of landlord costs. such as property taxes, insurance, and other operating costs. We don't think this is really a separate non-lease component. We think that's all one component of one revenue stream. And so we would just ask the board to clarify that. Thank you.
Okay. Rick?
Well, I guess big picture, leave with this. We believe that leases for lessees, leases do create assets and liabilities. And we would encourage the board to finish the project rather than to drop the project. As we've talked today, we got all kinds of suggestions for you. But big picture, we do think that they are assets and liabilities that should be reflected on the statement of financial position for lessees.
Okay. George?
From the lessor's perspective, if the objective is for symmetry between the lessor and lessee accounting, we would encourage the FASB to address the lessee first and then look towards symmetry. We fundamentally don't believe that the current lessor accounting has an issue. We think that issue is primarily on the lessee side. If the FASB was trying to do symmetry, then we would look towards using the existing models already contained in GAAP, primarily the capital lease models instead of the proposed type A. We believe that that would help in terms of driving symmetry and then could leverage existing disclosures that users are already familiar with, particularly with the finance receivables.
Okay. Ed?
I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I think these roundtables are very helpful. Appreciate all of you taking the time to listen to our input. Fundamentally, at the end of the day, we do feel like real estate leases are different than equipment leases. We do feel that leases are executory. We feel comparable to the Investor Advisory Committee that existing GAAP is sufficient, perhaps with some additional footnote disclosure. And that really, when you weigh the cost and benefit, the existing operating versus capital, or if you want to call it finance versus non-finance, is really a representationally more faithful way of providing information to users and investors that they can utilize however they wish, instead of the derived and construed information that the new exposure draft would require, would allow each company to produce on their own. Short of that, we would ask that that you look at in the transition things like loan covenants, and that you also take a look at economic impacts and do field testing. It's a very significant change. There is a potential for enormous impact, and we think that needs to be adequately studied before it's rushed into. Thank you again for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Okay. Go ahead, Elias.
Yeah, I also want to thank you for the opportunity for today to be able to express our views. Similar to what I've said earlier, we do agree there's not all leases are the same. There's two different types of leases. The current lessor accounting model recognizes that. It provides the users of our financial statement with relevant and useful information. It's easy to understand, and it gives them what they want. If there's anything deficient in it, we could fix it through additional disclosure. The concern about the proposal using S&P's words, that it runs the risk of impairing our income statement, I don't think that's helpful. The cost of implementing it does not justify that move. And while we do agree that there should be symmetry, I don't think symmetry should be objective if it impairs the financial statements.
Kimber?
Also, I'd like to thank the boards and staff for providing the opportunity to discuss the issues at these roundtables. Any change to accounting is going to involve cost, and the more dramatic changes are going to involve more dramatic costs. I think this set of proposals would have a high level of cost associated with it. The cost obviously is going to relate to not only changes in systems, changes in contracts, and there's a standard setting cost as well from what we can see in terms of the level of compromise that's needed to try to satisfy what users are looking for. We think as the boards consider how to move forward, there's a number of essential characteristics that are important in any high quality financial reporting model that you come up with. One of those is that it is broadly accepted by users so that it can reduce the amount of adjustments that are made to financial statements. Another is that it's complementary from a lessee and lessor perspective. Another is that it is internally consistent, that is, it's consistent across the primary financial statements. Another is that it's consistent with the concepts that apply broadly to assets and financial liabilities, as well as the other standards that the boards have that are consistent with their conceptual frameworks. And then another is that it's done in a way that tries to minimize the cost to the extent that's feasible. Of all of those characteristics, the one that I have the most question about is the one about broadly satisfying financial statement users, because there do appear to be so many different perspectives about what is useful to financial statement users. And it may be that as the boards look at that, that the best you can do right now is a disclosure package with enhanced disclosures so as not to compromise to the extent that you really damage what you're doing in other areas from an accounting perspective.
Okay. Pat Bailey?
I, too, would like to thank you for the opportunity. No matter how much time we would have allotted to this, I'm sure we would have run out of time because there are a lot of issues with this. And I echo Kimber's comments very specifically as he was talking about all the attributes that you would be looking at for this piece of guidance. I somewhat realize that if you were able to find all those things, that none of us would be alive yet by the time we came to those conclusions. So, but the one that he finalized with is my biggest concern, which is there is not an agreement on how these things are looked at from the users of the financial statements and what their needs are. So to implore the costs that are going to be out there for lessees of real estate that don't have systems today at all, change systems for people who have equipment leases, have transition periods, et cetera. The cost of that is extremely prohibitive for a lot of companies to be able to do that, for then to increase disclosures that you're going to have so that analysts can look at it in a different way than they did today, or make the adjustments that they want to make so that they can get to the way that they're viewing things today. So I would implore you to keep it as simple as possible. We didn't talk about today. One of the things I mentioned to Daryl, I think we kind of skipped talking about lessees and their borrowing, incremental borrowing rates, and how those are going to be determined, which I was going to be interested in hearing how that was going to be able to be defined by people as well, and the complexities that might be there. So as much as what we can keep things simple, scoping out leases that are immaterial to businesses, not having people try to create something for copiers and phones and things like that that are not material to their overall business would be helpful as well. But I wish you all good luck with this, because frankly it's an inordinate process that I'm not sure how you work your way out of it.
Thank you for the encouragement. Marianne, you're last here.
Okay, so I too would like to thank the boards. We've been very pleased as an industry with the outreach the boards have undertaken, not just with this project, but with revenue. So any of you involved with revenue, you know we've been very forthright and very active with you. So we really appreciate your efforts on that. We too probably reiterate some of the comments made about whether or not this is really an improvement, and just to keep an open mind to see if perhaps there would be a more efficient and practical way to achieve the objectives of the board without overburdening the users with understanding as well as the preparers. To reiterate again, we're concerned with the fact that the revenue proposal is coming out at the same time. Or probably before, I don't know the timing for this one, but that will be a lot to absorb. We also just want to reiterate one more time is to the boards to understand the unintended consequences perhaps to U.S. government contractors. Probably a consistent theme in all our responses have always been that impact. And although it's just a subset, it's a very important part of our business, and it does have a true and real impact to our bottom lines. And the last thing that I don't think was mentioned is also that we mentioned in our comment letter is some of the terminology that is used in the standard, such as insignificant, significant, minor. you know, it's not readily accepted in GAAP, and we're afraid that as it's used in some of, for example, the exceptions, is it really a practical, does it have a practical application? Could ever be met? And are these terms really understood by the preparers and users? Would it be consistent in its application? So we are a little concerned about the terminology that is being introduced in the standard. And again, I thank you, and I think you do have a big project ahead of you, and we appreciate the ability to come and talk to you today.
Okay. Thank you all for your terrific participation. It's made it very easy to chair this roundtable. Before we wrap up, Danielle's going to update us on the remaining outreach efforts, and then I'll turn to the board members to see if they have any final comments.
Okay, thank you. As most of you know, since we issued the exposure draft in May, we have been doing extensive outreach. We have been actually meeting with users of financial statements. We've been meeting with preparers all over the globe, both the ISB boards and staff and the FASB boards and staff, and have gotten a lot of great feedback. We've obviously had these roundtable experiences in Brazil. We've had two in London, two in Norwalk. We have another one this afternoon that will specifically focus more on the non-public entity aspects, and then Singapore tomorrow. I think we've gone over the 600 mark on comment letters on our website. So we will be doing a thorough analysis of those comment letters. And our hope is that at the November joint board meeting, the staff will present a summary of all of our outreach activities, including the roundtables, the individual meetings, the liaison meetings that we've had with different industry groups, as well as the comment letter summary. And we'll propose a redeliberation plan for going forward for the boards to consider. And then we hope that at the December joint meeting, we can begin redeliberations. And everyone wants to know when it's going to go final. And it just depends how quickly the redeliberations go, how quickly the boards can make some decisions. The hope is to try to finalize something in 2014, knowing that the boards have heard loud and clear that there would be a generous implementation period from the date of issuance to when the effective date might be. So that will be taken into consideration as we wind through the redeliberations next year.
Okay, let me ask the board members if they have any parting comments, starting with Larry.
Just thanks for your wishes of luck.
As you can see, there's a commonality of belief about what leases are when we listen to everyone. And that obviously is a challenge for us. Obviously, we have to figure out what the base economics of the transactions are before we can prescribe accounting, and that has been an ultimate challenge in our deliberations here. And you've seen us go back and forth in that journey, and we'll continue trying to be able to tell you what we think the asset is or what the economics of the transaction are. We're very well aware of the cost-benefit issues, and we're going to do everything that we can to be contemplating and minimizing those as much as possible as we go forward. You will note that there are not users at the table today. That's not infrequent at our roundtables, but I assure you, I want you to know that we've done a lot of outreach to users in this time period, and we will be publishing a memo about what we've heard from them. And unlike our Investor Advisory Council, there is a significant majority belief from the users that leases create assets and liabilities for the lessee. And that may be a foundation that we end up thinking about when we go forward. But obviously, we understand that we have to be providing information to best help users make their decisions going forward and then balance out the understanding of what the economics of the contracts and minimize cost and benefits. And we will try to do that as well as we possibly can.
Jim?
Tom, there is an update on our website right now of the user summary on the outreach activities we have done from May to September.
Okay.
So I agree with Tom in terms of moving forward with a sound basis of what it is we're viewing the transaction to be. I think that will actually help, not completely satisfy a cost-benefit analysis, but will help with more sound consideration of costs and benefits, and certainly this type of outreach and input from you, I think, is very useful for us to consider, are there ways to accomplish similar or the same objective in a less costly manner? I did want to respond to the broader impact analysis, which is something I think the board needs to be cognizant of, but I think it's a very challenging issue for us because, you know, I think the history of the board would say we heard similar things in trying to improve pension accounting, that it might have broader economic impacts than just the cost of implementing the standard. And I think one of the things, at least I view as a board member, is accounting does matter. And sometimes it does, if you can get the transaction and the economics portrayed correctly, that may have an impact. It's, again, not something we should be oblivious to. But I think we also need to consider the impact of not acting. If you go back again to pension accounting and say, you know, had the board not put in a standard recognizing post-employment benefits or pensions, what would have been the economic impact of not acting in terms of efficient allocation of capital? And so I think that cuts both ways, and it's a tough consideration for the boards.
Okay, and finally, Darrell.
I would just like to echo the thanks to all of you for taking your time to come and give us this input. It's very valuable for us. Thank you for your understanding of the difficulty of the task that we have before us. I think the only other comment I would like to make is, you know, as Kimber was describing what he and his firm would look for in a good solution, I think to a man, we would all agree that, yes, those are all characteristics that we would like to achieve and strive for. But obviously the difficulty here is up to this point, we've been unable to come up with a solution that you could tick off each one of those and say, we've got it. So what we're left with is each of us individually as board members, you know, have to make trade-offs in what's most important, knowing that we probably can't achieve it all, and just hoping that in the net what we come up with is beneficial for users and able to be done in a reasonable cost for preparers. So thanks to everybody for your time.
Again, I also want to finally thank everyone for their time, both folks around the table and those of you in the audience. So thank you for being part of this roundtable. And with that, the roundtable is adjourned.
Yeah, so this board member will be
a lot of fun time.